Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome artist Roger Shimomura. He will be giving a lecture titled An American Diary on Thursday, March 5th at 7 o'clock in the Library and Technology Center Auditorium on the Institute of American Indian Arts campus. That's a free event. And his work will be shown in an exhibition titled Roger Shimomura, Mini Doka on My Mind, which opens on Friday, March 6th and runs through April 18th at the 8 Modern Gallery here in Santa Fe at 231 Delgado Street. And all of this is co-sponsored by the Institute of American Indian Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, and Santa Fe Gin. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So your exhibition, which is called Mini Doka on My Mind, is an exhibition of paintings that tells the story of your family's internment during World War II. You were a small child at that time. What are your memories from then?
Well, my memories as a young child have mostly to do with the general conditions in camp. And weather certainly is the most prevalent memory that I have. Because the camp was located on a desert in southern Idaho on lava beds separated from practically all civilization, the weather conditions were extreme. I remember the howling winds and the heavy rains and the snow on one hand, and then on the other hand, I remember how hot and dusty it was. And then I remember a few incidents that I've tried to capture in some artwork.
Tell us about some of those incidents.
Well, I think one of the most dramatic ones I remember was not too long after we were placed in the internment camps, our neighbor from Seattle came to visit us. And because things were still in disarray, there wasn't a formal procedure that was set up for visitors to visit people in the camps. And so we spoke through the barbed wire fence. And I remember his name was Mickey O'Leary, and his mother were outside of the camps, and Mickey and I talked to each other. Of course, I don't remember what we talked about, but I imagine that that made for quite a dramatic sight. But most of the other incidents had to do usually with incidents that were not very comfortable, such as the time that I contracted the measles and was quarantined. And my mother and I were both put in an empty barrack room and served our meals through a slot in the door in a room that virtually had no furniture whatsoever, other than a mouse that would periodically appear and run around the house that really disturbed my mother, but became one of my friends until one day, actually it was about a week or so of not seeing the mouse, I discovered that my mother had found it and had killed it with a broom, and I discovered the body in the garbage can right outside the front door.
And those are the kind of memories that children hold on to. It's so interesting. Your parents were American citizens. How did they react? I mean, a child's response, an adult's response, of course, is different to being suddenly put in an internment camp.
Well, I was young enough that I don't remember what their response was. However, I do know what their response was once we got out of camp and got home. Back to Seattle after 3 years, and that response was not to talk about it. And it was made clear by my father that that was a subject that was out of bounds, and not one that our family was to ever discuss. And I made several attempts through the years when I got to high school, for example, and wanted to write a paper about that experience. You know, I had a vague idea what it was about, but it was from the very little that I could find to read about it. But my father made it clear to me that we were not to discuss that ever in the house. And so it wasn't until college that I believe CBS did a broadcast, and shortly after that, other both newspapers and magazines started coming out with articles about that whole internment experience. But it wasn't until the hearings for the reparations began in the mid-70s that my father and his entire generation, called Nise, the second generation, it wasn't until then that they finally spoke about it. And it was quite a dramatic moment when that did happen, when the results of the hearings were made public. And it was like a dam breaking, holding back all those years, all those stories that they wanted to tell. And as soon as I imagine one or two people decided to talk about it, the dam erupted and the entire community spoke out.
And did your family speak out as well? Did you finally hear your own parents' stories?
Well, I did directly from them. They didn't participate. They weren't asked to be in the hearings. But at that point, my father in particular was interviewed and by some community newspapers. And I sat there and listened to the interview and actually read some of the interviews and heard for the first time a lot of the stories that he had to tell. But it was interesting in the sense that he drew a line as to what he would talk about. He was telling one reporter stories of being stripped naked and being forced to stand there in front of people because he questioned the way some of the soldiers were handling me and the way that they sort of ripped me out of his arms to inoculate me. And when he protested, they made him take his clothes off and stand there naked. And when the reporter was writing the story down, my father said, no, don't print that. That's too embarrassing. So I don't know, you know, if this was typical of a lot of the other Nisei people that, you know, there were some stories that were possibly too embarrassing or too horrific to become public, but that was the case with my father.
What do you think it does for a community when there's a moment like this, when the dam breaks and these stories start really getting told? How do things change?
Well, there are probably a lot of other historical incidents that parallel this. I believe very firmly that there is a huge segment of our society that simply can't believe that these things happen and believe even more strongly that they could not happen again. But this certainly is something that has proven itself to have a potential second life and third life. If you witness the Iran hostage crisis years ago and Operation Desert Storm and the results of 9/11, in all incidents, there was a lot of talk by the government that was in charge at the time about rounding up people on the basis of their race or their religion and having them prove their loyalty. In other words, being judged as being guilty first and then being forced to prove their innocence. So this is something that could happen again and is something that the entire community at large should be concerned about.
So, for the what I hear you saying is it's as important for the people who weren't there as it is for the people who were there that those stories be told.
That's correct.
So you do these paintings. We're talking to the artist Roger Shimomura, and you do these paintings that many of them look like kind of a combination of Japanese and American styles. How did you start painting the subject matter that you're showing in this exhibition, Minidoka on My Mind, and how did you work out the style that you use?
Well, the style comes from an interest that I've always had in comic books from the time that I was a child and used to collect comic books. And, you know, like most artists, I drew incessantly as a child and would copy images out of comic books. And then I used to collect comic books for a period of time. So that part came almost without any kind of questioning. As far as the subject matter itself goes, I believe it was in the middle to late 70s, and it was because of the fact that I was participating in some of the early movements toward reparations for those Japanese Americans that were in camp, that was on my mind, and I decided that I wanted to do a series of paintings based upon that experience. And since that time, 1976, I believe it was, I've revisited the topic in three other major series of paintings, and two of them were based upon the translations of my grandmother's diaries. She was the immigrant that came over in 1912 and led a very, very colorful life as a midwife who delivered over 1,000 babies in the Pacific Northwest, and I was the last baby that she delivered. And but from the day that she decided to come to this country, she began a diary and maintained that diary for 56 years of her life. And because they were written in Japanese, I had to have them translated. And I began with the camp, the internment years, and did two series of paintings that were based upon those translations that came from how she saw the internment and her daily experiences and so on.
Did you first start reading those diaries after her death?
Yes. She died in 1968, and I brought the diaries back from Seattle to Kansas probably 1978 or so. And then I did the first diary series in 1980.
So what did you find in them when you started? I mean, when you started reading them, what kind of things did she choose to write in her diaries?
Well, interestingly enough, I don't think that she had ever intended anyone to read these diaries. She was a very literate person and wrote beautifully, as I'm told, and had a sense of being a pioneer in this country. And so she wrote a lot of articles for some of the Japanese language newspapers that were published in Seattle, recounting a lot of the stories and traditions that you know came with her from Japan, and so when she wrote in these diaries, she wrote in a very informal kind of way, a lot of sort of daily events that would probably not interest most people, but was sort of an accounting for her of how she passed time. When I first read the translations, I wasn't sure that there was enough information in there to do a series of paintings from, but I had some other people read them, and they saw a lot more than I did at the time and thought that it was a real treasure trove of history and events and so on that And so it caused me to look at them a little bit more carefully. And sure enough, from that point, I started to see the real value of her writings.
You also did performance pieces based on them. Tell us some of the stories that are portrayed in those pieces in the theater.
Well, one of the biggest ones I did was the history of Japanese Americans in this country. I mean, it was also one of the first ones I did, too. I started off sort of biting off way more than I could chew. And it was three acts, the first act being sort of a dedication to the Issei, or the, my grandparents' generation, the immigrants to this country. And the second act was the Nisei, which was all about the internment. And then the third act was the Sansei, which is my generation, and sort of issues of acculturation, you know, into the fabric of this country. And the prelude to the entire performance was my grandmother reading a story about her experiences in the Japan-Russian War as a Red Cross nurse. And this is one of the stories that I was referring to that she wrote. It was quite dramatic because she was on a Red Cross ship at the Battle of Port Arthur, which was the deciding victory in the Japan-Russian War in 1904. And so the prelude to the performance was this actor reading out the story and miming the story as best as she could. And some of the other performances I said were based upon certain poems that my grandmother wrote, or haikus that she wrote, or stories that her friends wrote that she had collected. Also, songs that the Issei, the first generation, used to sit around and sing at nighttime, that kind of defied the notion that Japanese Americans were quiet and accepting and docile about the whole internment experience. The Issei were mad, and it was clearly reflected in the songs and the text of the poems that they recited and sang.
We're talking to artist Roger Shimomura. You did a piece several years ago called Stereotypes and Admonitions, and for each painting you have a story, and the stories are about various incidents or prejudices related to Asian Americans in the United States, and many of them, most of them, are just stunning and shocking. And I mean, for example, in 1970, you were a young professor in Lawrence, Kansas, where you are now, and you were not allowed to apply for a credit card because they said in a very rude way, we don't give credit cards to Indians in a particular department store. Many stories like that. I wondered if how you have seen, what kind of changes you have seen in the years since then.
Well, actually, not many. I've sort of continued that clipping file on these stories that cover not only things that have happened to me directly, but things that have happened to the Asian American population at large. And my file now is probably three times as large as when I did that series of work several years ago. So it continues, and I'm sure that a lot of these things just sort of either go over the head or are not noticeable to people that it doesn't concern. But believe me, when you're at the end of or you're the punchline of some incident that occurs, you feel it and you remember it for a long time. It's a series that I'm thinking that I may resume someday, simply because, you know, as you say, it's just sort of amazing that these things have happened. And I'm subscribing to several newspapers that are published by and for Japanese Americans. They're usually filled with stories of this sort.
It does. I mean, one thinks that things must have changed since 1970 because we probably couldn't have elected a black president at that time. Now we have. But from your perspective, it's really not as nearly as much change as you'd like.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, we've come so far in terms of race relations, but in particular with the African-American community. But what amazes me is how the public or they differentiate between the African-Americans and Asian-Americans, and probably because Asian-Americans have had a reputation develop around their presence of being quiet and being accepting and not boat rockers and all of that, and so they wouldn't think of say, you know, if you were to substitute African American for Asian American, they wouldn't think of doing the kinds of things or saying the kinds of things that they do towards Asian Americans, but you know, somehow you know, we're really, we've fallen behind the curve in terms of level of understanding of those kinds of issues in our community.
What do you think are the most successful agents for change in the fight against racial prejudice?
Well, personally, I think that, when these incidents come up, I think more needs to be made of it. I'm really tired of people, after offending a whole community, saying, "I apologize if I offended you." They don't apologize, for being stupid. They don't apologize for being ignorant or being thoughtless. They apologize for having offended you, which is a very, very different, issue or way of looking at it. And that's why I think that, as I bring my exhibitions around the country, and especially when I show at museums, there's a today there's a big emphasis that's placed upon the educational programming that goes around what I do, and this certainly is not just me, but it has to do with a whole group of artists that are working with these kinds of issues. And I think that, frequently those educational treatments of the exhibition end up becoming part of public school programming. And I know I've worked in the last 20 years or so on several educational packets that were actually administered in public school programs in various parts of the country. And, that's a very direct way of how, the art-making process directly affects and educates people on how to think and becoming more sensitized to these issues that we're talking about.
You wrote a piece about your life in which you talked about the fact that your father was a pharmacist in Seattle, and then he was allowed eventually to leave the Minidoka internment camp where you were, provided that he looked for work somewhere else in the United States. And so he went to Chicago, and you, your family ended up in Chicago for a while, where he was employed by a German-American. And it made me think about the many examples that we have in this country's history about various immigrant groups helping each other out when the mainstream society doesn't really help them. And I'm wondering what kind of solidarity you see among the various immigrant and racial groups in this country today.
Well, I think that most groups now can appreciate each other from that standpoint, and whether or not this is a result of that educational process slowly working, perhaps in the public schools at a very young age, or what, but or if it's just a product of the fact that for the last 20 or 30 or 40 years or so, the society has just become more sensitized and understanding of the fact that we all have sort of a common cause. But clearly, I think things have improved in that regard. And, a case in point might be the fact that Asian Americans are more frequently starting to refer to themselves as Japanese Americans or Korean Americans or Chinese Americans, because each of those immigrant groups have their own issues, and now perhaps the door is cracked enough to allow us to see that, there are differences between different kinds of Asian groups. Southeast Asians, being more recent immigrants, certainly have different issues than the Chinese Americans that have been here for a long period of time. So I think clearly, there has been some improvement in that perception.
Now, the work on stereotypes, and a lot of the work you've done, is being welcomed by the Institute of American Indian Arts, where you will be a guest. You'll be giving a lecture there on Thursday, the 5th of March. What kind of connections have you had with the Native American community?
Well, I've had quite a bit of connection, actually, largely due to the fact that Haskell Indian Nations University is located here in Lawrence, Kansas. And I've had direct involvement with a lot of their projects and have gotten to know, a lot of the faculty that teach there. And I've been in the process because I've accumulated so many things, books and things of that sort, that I've been giving them to Haskell and intend on giving a lot more to them over the next few years. Also, being good friends with Jean Quick-to-See Smith, who resides there in Corrales, she has done a lot to educate me and again, I think, there's a common cause that we have in what we do in our studios. And I certainly have valued our friendship and, have to say that I've learned so much from her.
Roger Shimomura, thank you so much for being with us today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And Roger Shimomura is an artist who will be giving a lecture titled An American Diary on Thursday, March 5th at 7 o'clock in the Library and Technology Center Auditorium on the Institute of American Indian Arts campus. That's a free event. And his work will be shown in an exhibition called Roger Shimomura, Minidoka on My Mind, opening on Friday, March 6th and running through April 18th at the 8 Modern Gallery on 231 Delgado Street here in Santa Fe. And that's all for now. We're going to take a little break. We'll be with you in just a moment.